Hello, I'm Michael Serapio, and this is the Primetime Politics Podcast.
Tonight on Primetime Politics, a pox on all their houses.
Ministers' radical policies are actually killing people.
As MPs debate the decriminalization of drugs, a new study says the divisive language and polarization between the parties is turning Canadians off. It's also leading to historically low approval ratings for all the party leaders. We'll discuss both matters with our political panel. And
I think Trudeau finds his mission as he goes along, and his mission becomes survival.
Justin Trudeau on the ropes. We will speak with veteran political journalist Paul Wells about his new book on the Prime Minister and find out what prevents Justin Trudeau from throwing in the towel. This is Primetime Politics. Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Serapio. The Conservative opposition is taking another step in its fight against a pilot project in British Columbia, introducing a motion today that would prevent any other program hoping to decriminalize the possession of illicit drugs and also end the government's safe drug supply program, which the Conservative leader says is fueled by corporate greed.
Our approach is to meet with recovery centers, all of whom have been unanimous in telling me that that minister's radical policies are actually killing people and not stopping the harm, but perpetuating the harm. That minister and the NDP government in BC have perpetuated the harm because the apparatus of corporate, pharmaceutical, and activist groups that are profiting off of this crisis have kept it going.
Well, let's bring in our political panel to talk about the Conservative motion. Susan Smith is principal and co-founder of the Blue Sky Strategy Group. Josie Sabatino is a senior consultant with Summa Strategies. And Anne McGrath, principal secretary to the NDP leader. Hello to the three of you.
Hello.
Okay, so when we look at this Conservative motion, it really has two parts to it, right? Like, first, it's to deny any future requests to, and this is the word the Conservatives use, legalize hard drugs in a jurisdiction. Second, it's to end, again, what the motion describes as taxpayer funded narcotics that goes essentially to the safe drug supply. Is Pierre Poilievre just fighting, and this is using his terminology, for a more common sense policy on this?
I think he's got a political, it's his usual political air war on this. Poilievre never misses an opportunity to do something. You said, you highlighted the word legalize there. The pilot project was with BC was decriminalization, and the pilot project came about because the government of BC asked to work with Health Canada, with the government of Canada, to be able to do this. It failed. There's no question that it failed. I think there'll be lessons learned from it, and the decriminalization is going to be walked back. But Mr. Poilievre never misses an opportunity to blow additional hot air into something that, in terms of the framing of it, the hot air is right in the fact that it's the opioid crisis is a major issue. Governments have to do something. The government of BC tried a different approach. It didn't work, but they said it didn't work, so we'll try something else. So I think it's not constructive what Mr. Poilievre is doing. He's using it for points and for mailing opportunities for fundraisers.
Mm-hmm. And Josie?
Well, I think when we're talking about decriminalization and safe supply, in isolation, these policies make sense. But in the practical application that we've seen in BC, we've seen some real policy failings. And every time, you know, somebody came forward to blow the whistle about these kind of things, they were labeled as fearmongers. But what we've realized out of all of this is that there were very real concerns. I mean, the deputy chief of police from Vancouver testified at the federal committee saying that safe supply was being sent into the black market. And that's something that it has really real consequences, not only because it's taxpayer funded, but because those drugs end up back in the supply and out there for people to obtain. So I think Mr. Poilievre, you know, when he's talking about this, he really is hitting on some of those concerns that Canadians have brought forward.
Anne, what do you say to that?
Well, first of all, I would say that British Columbia and
really everywhere across the country is dealing with a serious health emergency, I think. And there are things that some things that have been shown to work and other things haven't, right? So I think that this is a very politicized, it's basically weaponizing a health crisis for political gain. But really, I mean, I think that you have to look at this from the lens of being compassionate, compassionate to the users of drugs, and really, really pay attention to the dangers of the toxicity that's going into the drug supply, and the families and loved ones who are dealing with this, but also the public who wants to feel like they have that they're not being kind of faced with a lot of the really dangerous aspects of this. So, alcohol is decriminalized, but you can't walk down the street with a bottle of beer, right? So I think that you can have decriminalization and still have some kind of rules around how that decriminalization is rolled out. But it has to come from a place of compassion and recognizing that this is a health crisis, not a criminal issue.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but without a doubt, there's a wedge element in this motion as well, right? Because
Absolutely.
the preamble in it clearly says the following, that, quote, since the NDP Liberal Prime Minister took office, opioid overdose deaths across Canada have increased by 166%. I hear the argument you're making here, Anne, but I wonder about Liberals and New Democrats, whether or not they're going to have a hard time making that point to Canadians, because the point is more complex than the criticism.
Well, there is a difficulty in describing all the complexities around this. But one thing I do know is that there probably aren't very many families in Canada that haven't had some firsthand experience with the problem of the opioid crisis. And one of the big problems, and you're right, it's a hard one to communicate, but one of the big problems is that when someone decides that they want recovery or treatment, it has to be there for them. And it's a big problem is that someone might say, I'm ready to stop, and then they get put on a wait list for 6 months, a year, whatever that is. So I don't think you can say that there's one problem or one solution. And I don't think you should be cutting things off from just a kind of an ideological point of view.
Mm-hmm. Susan, what do you say to that? Because, the government does find itself, even if you say this was a BC request and ask of the federal government still had to grant that request.
Yeah, but I think this is a case actually where cooperative federalism works, ironically, because the BC government worked with the federal government to try a pilot. A pilot, by its own very nature, is an experiment. And the federal government, they found a way to attempt this pilot. It didn't work, so the two are cooperating again to walk it back. I mean, that's why you have federal provincial jurisdictions. I mean, healthcare is a provincial issue. The case of illegal drugs is a federal issue. I think.
But how do you sell that to Canadians, though, when, again, there's this complexity in the answer versus really an argument being made that this is a problem, this program's not working?
Mr. Poilievre would like to simplify it and say, whatever the rain outside is Mr. Trudeau's fault, the opioid crisis is Mr. Trudeau's fault, the fact you have a cold is Mr. Trudeau's fault. He likes to boil it right down, and that's very easy from a political messaging perspective, if you want. You're right, it is a complicated message to try on the other side. But I think we need all levels and all partners to address the issue. There are things the feds can do, greater border services, more RCMP collaboration, but there are municipal and provincial police forces. And so it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. And because of our jurisdiction, our Section 91, Section 92, the provinces usually scream if you step into provincial jurisdiction on healthcare. So we have to collaborate to deal with this issue. It's a health and safety issue for people, both in communities and for the people, the addicts themselves. And you have to find a path using best evidence to go forward. And sometimes you make mistakes. You try something and it doesn't work. But you're never going to find a solution if you don't take brave moves to try and work your way through it.
Mm-hmm. Josie, what do you say to that? The fact that this is clearly a wedge issue by spelling out what they have done, but by making it a wedge issue, are you weaponizing, as Anne says, not you, as the Conservative Party weaponizing what is essentially now understood to be a more health issue than a criminal issue?
Well, I think what has come out of this and is something that we'll reflect on, you know, when we look back on this in history, is that these types of policies are born out of desperation. And Anne mentions this. We want to be compassionate. We want to find solutions. And the problem is so large and it affects so many communities and every level of government. But the problem is now that we've gone through this pilot project, we've seen the results 1 year in, the consensus around decriminalization has totally collapsed and it has shown itself the many failings that are there. So I think, you know, as we're reflecting on this, we really need to be cognizant of having the safeguards in place before we really test out these kind of policies that have real societal consequences, real human consequences. And I think Pierre Poilievre, will see him put forward his vision for this and we'll see if it's successful. But I think, you know, the Liberals and the NDP really need to figure out what their message is on this.
As you say, we will see. But listen, before we're out of time, I do want to switch topics before we're done here, because I want to talk about this new study that came out today. It came from the Angus Reid Institute. And this the study, if you look at here, essentially looks at leaders and their popularity, and they have aggregated numbers here of both positive and negative impressions. And they say there has never been, and this is from the Institute, there's never been a time when leaders of all three parties simultaneously turn Canadians off to such an extent. And goes on to say, many pundits and observers have speculated that politics has never been this divisive, with party leaders who seek to exploit differences rather than overcome them. Even Canadians have voiced concern that there's no room for compromise or that their voices aren't heard. This frustration and division appears to have created the perfect conditions for political dissatisfaction, and this has culminated in historically unpopular leadership at the federal level. You know, what's your reaction to that when you see how poorly all leaders are doing across the board and blaming essentially what we're doing here in Ottawa, political parties and those that cover them?
Well, I would say that there is a particularly divisive and polarizing atmosphere in politics right now. I mean, you just have to look at the last week when, was it last week?
When, the
Wacko Week, that's right.
It was just last week.
It was just last week, unbelievable. That tells you everything, I think, actually. Yeah. But no, it is a very, very, there's a lot of hostility, there's a lot of conflict, there's a lot of polarization, a lot of division at a time when Canadians, I think, are not actually even paying that much attention to this, and they are concerned about affordability, housing costs, grocery costs, inflation, all of those kinds of things. And so I think that there's a disconnect between what is often perceived as sort of political games and shouting with being serious and getting down to work on the issues that people are facing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Susan, what do you say? Because it would seem to be that this is not the type of news any political party wants to ignore.
No, I don't think any political party should ignore that. It's a difficult time. What's different, I think, about this moment that we haven't ever had in history is we're off a pandemic, we're into challenges on affordability, and we have social media. So when you used to go to the coffee shop and complain to your neighbors, you complain to your neighbors and there may be 5, 10, or if you're really good, you had a soapbox and you had 20 people in your coffee shop to talk about. Now you can go onto social media and you can find hundreds, thousands of real or people or bots who will help reinforce the grumpiness that you might be feeling in that part of the day or that moment in time or that week or that spell. And so I think the amplifications of people's feelings in any particular moment is a lot greater than it ever has been historically in the past. We also live really close to the U.S. We've seen the stuff that goes on there. It blows north across the border with the wind and the weather. And I do think it has permeated Canadian society. So I do think all politicians need to pay attention to it. We need people to participate in our democratic process. We need to respect our politicians who pay attention to it, not throw things at them, not threaten their security. And we need people to vote. Mm-hmm. And so the politicians have to find a way to bring people back and give them comfort that they are there working for them.
Mm-hmm. Josie?
I think that's exactly right. I think about when we think about what will save us, it is our institutions and having faith in our politicians and our elected leaders. And so much of that was eroded with COVID and not being able to connect one-on-one. And Susan's right. We see this on social media. You get a quick 30-second soundbite and it's not substantive. It doesn't tell you about the issues that are impacting your life. And it's really just a lot of finger pointing. So I think, you know, once we get back to really having those events and seeing each other one-on-one again and really seeing local politicians in the light that they're supposed to be in, which is connecting with their constituents, I think, you know, that is the path forward, and it's the only path forward.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of fact-checking in a lot of this in the social media realm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that we're really missing that. I mean, as sort of traditional mainstream journalism is in a bit of a decline, that's where the fact-checking actually takes place, and it doesn't happen on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. You know, really quickly, 15 seconds from each of you, you know, we keep hearing time and again this need and desire for things to cool down. Do you think that message is being heard?
I think that actually it's being ramped up. Things aren't coming down. Things are being ramped up. And, you know, again, going back to what happened last week. And, I mean, I was in the House today for question period, and it was pretty raucous.
Yeah. Susan?
I think you have two major leaders who are willing to adjust the tone of politics. I think you have a leader of the opposition who likes the bombast and the nastiness, and he's not worried about his proximity to the truth. And so that's going to keep the temperature up.
Josie?
I think what's happening in the lives of Canadians and the difficulties we have ourselves, having really challenging conversations right now, is playing out in politics, and that's the reality. They can't talk to each other, but we also can't talk to each other. So how should we expect our political leaders to figure it out when sometimes we can't ourselves?
Okay, well, I'll drive the hope that we always talk to each other. So and Susan, yeah. Josie, thank you for the time. More to come on this in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks.
Well, time now for a look at what else happened in politics today. Several ministers took part in a news conference this morning, marking the start of wildfire season in Canada. The Emergency Preparedness Minister, Harjit Sajjan, announcing new measures aimed at mitigating and fighting fire. This comes as 87 fires, fueled by high temperatures and low precipitation, are already burning across the country.
That is what we are doing through Budget 2024 by adding $166 million to better support communities prepare for and fight wildfires. We're also doing things differently this year by offering advance payments to all communities so they can prepare earlier, incorporating traditional knowledge in their strategies and funding emergency management coordinators in more communities.
Ottawa hosted a National Air Accessibility Summit this morning. The move follows several reports of Canadians with disabilities failing to be accommodated while flying. That includes Canada's Chief Accessibility Officer, Stephanie Cadieux, who made headlines last fall when her wheelchair was left behind by Air Canada on a cross-country trip. Minister Kamal Khera announced the meeting did produce results, with industry members committing to develop a common intake form to simplify travel bookings. Also promises of doing more in the long term to improve the experience of travelers with disabilities.
In addition, industry will also explore ways to collect and share data with governments and Canadians so that they can better track incidents and identify problem areas.
Friends, we are not here to compromise on these issues.
And finally, protesters gathered on Parliament Hill today for the March for Life. The annual rally calls for the end of abortion and medically assisted death in Canada. A pro-choice counter-protest was also held on the Hill today. Well, as we heard in the political panel, no party leader is doing very well in the polls right now. But without a doubt, it is a bigger struggle for the Prime Minister. Nearly 9 years in power, and Justin Trudeau continues to trail Pierre Poilievre in public opinion. For months, no policy announcement nor initiative has been able to turn things around for the Prime Minister and his party. But despite months' worth of bad numbers, Trudeau still says he will stay on and fight another campaign, which leads many in Ottawa to wonder, why? Well, a new book by veteran political journalist Paul Wells may have the answer. It is out this week, and it is called Governing in Troubled Times, Justin Trudeau on the Ropes. Well, Paul Wells joins us now in studio. Paul, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
So, listen, I want to begin with the genesis of this book, because you wrote about it in your newsletter this week. Very interesting, because it was your publisher, Ken White, who had this idea of you writing about Justin Trudeau. And the quote that you attribute to him, he says, "He's been around for almost a decade, and I still have no idea why he's in office or why he's what he's trying to do." You know, writing and researching this retrospective, how would you answer that question?
I think he's trying to be helpful. I think Justin Trudeau figured that, he grew up in a surroundings where people would talk about him kind of offhandedly as a future prime minister. And I think he decided his time had come. Now, finding a mission to fit the moment was not easy. He himself, in his own memoir, has written about the stuff that they talked about when he was getting ready to run, what he was going to do if he became prime minister. And it's kind of cliched stuff. Make Quebec feel at home in Confederation, find a role for the strong and rising West, reflect Canada's diversity. Almost anyone who's been prime minister in the last 50 years would have had a kind of a similar list. So I understand my former boss's confusion. I think Trudeau finds his mission as he goes along, and his mission becomes survival.
It's survival. And I think evidence of that is kind of this ideological inconsistency that we've seen across almost 9 years now, because back in 2015 he was running on the middle class, criticizing the Harper government for running deficits. And here we are in 2024. Yeah. There's no word on the middle class, and this government is very much tied to deficits. What do you say about that ideological inconsistency and Trudeau and what it says about him as a leader?
He ran in 2015 appealing to the center in Canadian politics. As challengers often do, he thought the incumbent, Stephen Harper, had vacated the center, had radicalized, and left ordinary Canadians up for grabs. And he was quite successful. It was a solid majority, and it was the first government since Confederation to come from third place in the parliamentary standings to form a government. But over time, Canadian politics was already polarizing. I've got some academic research that demonstrates that. And the center that he wanted to occupy was crumbling. And our politics continued to polarize over the first few years of his time in office. So by 2019, he had to run on a contrast between himself and the Conservatives. And that territory, which necessarily pushes you further left if you're opposing Conservatives, became more comfortable with him.
Became more comfortable, and here we are now where, his future is being openly questioned and within the party, outside the party. And you keep using this boxing metaphor in the book when you talk about the prime minister and the way he views challenges that are in front of him. And in fact, we have a bit of your book on a board here for people at home, because you write this about Trudeau. Now he's on the ropes again. The new conservative opposition leader, Pierre Poilievre, has all but caved in Trudeau's ribcage in the opening round. To Trudeau, it all feels familiar and more reassuring than you probably expect. He was here before, in the space between what's happening and what you expect. He knows everyone is watching. Now, that seems to suggest that Justin Trudeau is not one to give up easily, even if everyone is pointing to him the eventual signs of defeat.
Yeah. So I sat down to write the book. It was a quick assignment from the idea coming up at the end of September to me publishing a manuscript in February, or sending it off to the publisher. So when I sat down to write, he had just finished all of his year-end interviews. And in a bunch of those year-end interviews, he says, how can you imagine me walking away from the fight now? It's when things are at their worst that I am most motivated and things like that. And I don't think those are just lines. I think he obviously grew up as a son of privilege. He obviously grew up in circumstances that almost none of us could imagine. And he grew up being used to people saying he doesn't add any value. He's just where he is because he was born on third place, on third base. And I think he wants to demonstrate that he does have resources. And so he is kind of attracted to circumstances where everyone thinks he's doomed, because that's when he thinks he does his best work.
Okay. Thinks he does his best work. There is no love lost between Trudeau and Pierre Poilievre. And I'm wondering if that aspect of the relationship inspires him to even hang on tighter than others might expect.
I mean, we'll find out. I don't think there's any certainty on questions like, will he lead the party in the next election? I believe that as of today, I mean, one day we'll know. If he leaves, we'll know when he made the decision. My hunch is that he hasn't made that decision yet. That as of today, he absolutely intends to lead the Liberal Party into an election. And I don't think he thinks that election is going to be a walk in the park. I think he thinks he's got a chance. So, but it's a long year, and every day I know he's got people close to him, people who want the best for him, telling him to get out. I know he's got a mirror, and he's going to look in that mirror every day and say, "Is this a guy who's really wants to go through this again?" You know. But I believe that as of now, he looks at potential successors, isn't impressed, looks at Polyev and feels motivated, and I think he wants to go again.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he elected in 2015, but then, of course, he comes across some extraordinary challenges that no one would have known about when he was first elected back then. I think about Donald Trump elected to the White House and the challenge that presented when Donald Trump wanted to reopen up NAFTA. I think about the global pandemic, which essentially shut down the global economy. When you look at how Justin Trudeau met the challenge of those moments, what does it say to you about his capability as a leader?
He's got a good story to tell about some of those big challenges. I believe that it would have been very easy for the Canada-US relationship to go much worse. Trump has no interest in Canada. As Al Capone said, he doesn't even know what street Canada's on. And he had already called NAFTA the worst deal in history. And he has had every legal right to cancel the deal. Instead, they saved it. They saved it so thoroughly that even with Biden in the White House, nobody wants to revisit that deal. And similarly with COVID, in the first year of the COVID pandemic, when the important work was to pay people to stay home and pay businesses to stay open without clients, Canada had more money because the four prime ministers before Justin Trudeau were fiscally responsible. And he was able to protect more Canadians than was the case in a lot of other countries. Later, COVID becomes much more controversial. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, on some of these big challenges, he's got a pretty good story to tell.
Mm-hmm. COVID becomes much more controversial, and that actually goes back to the point that you were making earlier about polarization in the political realm right now. You say politicians, Trudeau included, have weaponized the partisanship that we're now seeing. What's the advantage of that? What is the danger attached with it?
Well, I'm pretty sure it's become almost the only way to win elections. You run on a caricature of the other person rather than running on your best version of yourself. And Trudeau's hardly the first person to fall into that sort of tactical dynamic. And he won't be the last. But it strains the Confederation. It strains our complicated regional dynamics. It leaves a lot of people feeling left out. And that permits the rise of somebody like Pierre Poilievre, who wants to speak for those people who feel left out. And there's a lot of people who are more traditional liberal supporters who feel let down and disappointed by this government. So the thing with polarization is you need your side of the polarization to show up. And it's what we're seeing in public opinion polls is that's less and less guaranteed of people who did vote liberal the last three times, that they're not nearly as sure they're going to vote liberal the fourth time.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if people should be comforted or worried that you captured 9 years in 200 pages. 100 pages, rather.
It's a sprint.
No, but it's a very good book. But getting back to the initial question, at the end of the day, having gone through this, what do you think Canadians need to know about Justin Trudeau?
It's funny. It's a very critical book. I mean, I'm known as a guy who's not super impressed with this government. But I think anyone who reads it all the way through will come away with the impression that this guy means well and is trying his best, and that the circumstances matter. It's been a hellish decade for all of us, and would have been a very difficult decade in power for any prime minister. And so what I hope this short book accomplishes is to put him into more context.
Well, the book is called Justin Trudeau on the Ropes. The author is Paul Wells. Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Paul's book is on store shelves now. Well, that is our program for this Thursday. I'm Michael Serapio. For everyone here at CPAC, thank you for watching. Primetime Politics is back tomorrow evening. Until then, take care.